You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now think about the saying, find out what you're made of. Usually that's about character, values, toughness, more than, you know, the nuts and bolts of the human body. But what was the last time you actually got curious about what we are actually made of? Not just the hair and skin and organs and stuff, but the small stuff, the atoms. How about how the food we eat becomes us? In his new book, our next guest tackles these and other ultimate questions of life, the universe, and everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these things you are curious about, or were you as a kid? Do you have a question about what we're made of, what we're not made of, how we got to be what we are? Our next guest goes back to the Big Bang to start things off. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Levitt writes and produces science and history documentaries. His new book is called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I got to ask about the journey here, because if I thought of some of the starting questions you did, I might, you know, go online for a couple few minutes and then be done with it. Instead, you literally go from Big Bang to how we, you know, how our cells turn food into energy, plus the science behind it. What kicked off this journey?
You know, it started with a question. When my teenage daughter was thinking of becoming a vegetarian, I naturally was wondering what she would have to eat in order to remain healthy. And when I started thinking about it, I actually realized I have no idea what our bodies were made of. And a little bit more thinking, and I realized I actually don't even know where that stuff, whatever it was, came from. And then it kind of hit me, which was, wow, everything that's in our bodies now, every single particle, actually started 13.8 billion years ago at the Big Bang. And so that kicked off a whole lot of Googling and questioning. And, you know, what I discovered is not just that it's an amazing journey from there to here, but also the fact that we are made of particles from the Big Bang, and we can actually reconstruct that journey and look back and figure out how we got here. That's also just amazing. So how scientists discovered it also was something that just absolutely fascinated me.
I'm gonna go to some of the things that fascinated me that I learned in your book. So you mentioned some of our material, or all of it, originated 13.8 billion years ago. The bits of us that are hydrogen, which is a fair amount of us, that's the original material. Those are the same atoms as when the universe started?
That's it. And that's 10% of your body. But all the other atoms, which are different elements like oxygen and carbon and so on, their constituents, the electrons and the protons that they're made of, also came right out of the Big Bang.
But they needed a little work, right? So those bigger atoms, the carbons and things like that, how did they end up existing in the universe, first of all, much less being part of us?
Yeah, so once the Big Bang happened, there was a huge amount of oxygen that went out in massive clouds into the expanding universe. A large collections of those condensed into stars. And once that hydrogen was at higher and higher pressures, which gravity contracted into this higher and higher pressures and temperatures, it fused helium, and that liberated energy. And that, and when it liberated energy and the star got hotter, then it was able to make heavier elements with more protons in the nucleus. Every element has an additional proton compared to the one before it on the periodic table. So as stars created heavier elements and it released more energy, that allowed the stars to make even heavier elements until the element iron, which has 40 protons in its nucleus. After that, the rest of the elements in the universe and in our body were made by the most powerful explosions in the universe, which were supernovas, the massive explosions of stars.
Okay, and that's all amazing. But then here's the really baffling thing to me. Most of me is nothing. There's gaps among the atoms, the molecules between them. There's more nothing than something in a human body.
Yeah, that's I really have a hard time getting my head around it as well. But if you look at an atom, like just a hydrogen atom, 99% of it is empty space. So if you took the nucleus and you blew it up so that it was the size of a tennis ball, the electrons are worrying a mile away. So there's a huge amount of empty space within our body, so much so that some of the tiniest particles that we know of, like, called neutrinos, they can just shoot right through us.
We are talking about what we're made of with author Dan Levitt. His new book is What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions, your experiences in studying these things, maybe at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, this is a good topic. It's something I've internalized. I've read recently that men, male Americans at least, part of a research study, are deficient in magnesium. And I read that the magnesium chemical or nutrient affects how our body, how the synergy of the energy affects, that magnesium affects the relationship between the atoms in our body, and the deficiency is a negative thing, and we need to eat more magnesium. Is that enough of a question?
Jeff, I got you. If you don't mind, Jeff, I'm going to take us on a detour into the 19th century, Dan, where scientists were really tackling questions of what do we need to eat? What happens if we eat these things? What happens if we don't eat these other things? Can you talk about the quest to narrow that down?
Yeah, well, that's fun because, in the 19th century, we didn't know that we do need some minerals like magnesium. And you might wonder how they ever figured it out. And one way they figured it out was they knew that our food has proteins, fats, carbohydrates in them. And so they made artificial food with those constituents and fed them to animals like laboratory rats. And they discovered that they got sick. And so by a process of deduction, they were able to figure out that, oops, you know, we need chlorine, we need magnesium, we need potassium, we need sulfur. There are certain mineral and iron we have to get from plants in addition to the other things that we already knew about.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Another component we need, and I want to go to this one because a lot of these were discovered at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, vitamins. And I want to get it. You share the story of scurvy, which I thought I knew, right? Sailors got scurvy. They didn't eat oranges. They didn't get enough vitamin C in their diet. Easy peasy. Except people figured this out and then forgot about it again and again. Can you talk about why it was so hard to connect the dots between this horrific condition that killed thousands of sailors and just eating some oranges?
Yeah, it's baffling when you look at the face of it. Scurvy is a terrible disease, and the British Navy suffered dreadfully from it. And there was a while when ships' captains knew that if they had fresh vegetables, and particularly if they had lemons or oranges, and fed them to their sailors, they wouldn't suffer from it. But I think people got very complacent about it. And the thing that was the real killer was, at the time, no one had the concept of a vitamin. A vitamin is a weird thing. You know that if you eat something, you'll get sick from it. But who would think that if you don't eat a tiny bit of something that you've never heard of, that'll also make you sick? And at the time, there... theories of disease were about were really the Greek theories of the humors, that all the diseases they thought were created by these four humors in the body that were in imbalance. And so they didn't have the concept of a vitamin. And so it took a long, long time for them, for scientists to even get that idea in their heads. And in the meantime, the millions and millions of British sailors, among many, many other people, died from it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this is a bit of a tangent, and I apologize in advance. But I read a lot of Terry Pratchett's novels, and in a couple of the Discworld books, he includes a little song that, knowing Terry, I'm not sure how much of it is, you know, taken from actual old songs and how much of it is him, but it's iron enough to make a nail, lime enough to paint a wall, water enough to drown a dog. And it goes on like that for a little bit. And it's just talking about all the things that it takes to make a man. And I just thought it's kind of interesting that, you know, you go back all these hundreds, if not thousands of years, and people have you tried to figure out, like, okay, but what makes us alive?
I gotcha, Michael. Thanks a lot. You kind of break down how much of product element X it takes to make a human, as that song tried to do, Dan.
Yeah, I love that. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you have a carbon enough to make 25 pounds of charcoal. You've got enough salt in your body to fill a salt shaker. You have enough chlorine to disinfect a couple backyard swimming pools. And enough iron, your caller was exactly right, to make a 3-inch nail. And furthermore, he was right because your body is over 50% water.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to science and history documentarian Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about anything we've been talking about his journey to learn the history of the stuff we're made of, the atoms and molecules and nutrients and how they get there? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Ahead this afternoon on Central Time, a lot of apologies are bad, but it doesn't have to be that way. Our guests share how to give a good apology and what to do when you're not getting the apology you deserve.
Tomorrow on the morning show, the pandemic put a spotlight on indoor air quality in schools and the importance of proper ventilation. A New York Times investigation finds many schools still need to improve. We discuss after 7:30.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dan, before we go back to our callers, a big part of your book is about the scientists who made the discoveries you're looking at and the workings of science. And an amazing theme seems to be scientists propose this idea. Everybody dismisses it as ridiculous, but then some of them say, okay, I'm going to try to disprove it. And they can't disprove it, and it becomes accepted science. What did you learn just about the way scientific progress works?
You know, I always thought that that science is just follow the evidence. But when I was researching all of these amazing discoveries, I discovered that at the time that they were first presented, so many of them, the vast preponderance of them that I looked at in my book, were just completely dismissed when they were initially presented, or the scientists treated them with complete scorn. And you know, so I discovered that there were six particular reasons that made whole communities of scientists very skeptical of radical new discoveries, not incremental ones, but radical ones. You know, one of them, I gave them nicknames, right? One of them is the too weird to be true bias. When scientists first proposed that the universe was not static, but was expanding, I mean, huh? No way, right? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. You know, when scientists first proposed that organic molecules, which are the molecules that our bodies are made of, which are not rock, but they're longer chains of molecules could exist in space, people were completely skeptical. And then often people had faith in the world's greatest experts and didn't always examine really carefully the assumptions that those experts made. And so, you know, I learned that these kinds of cognitive biases in the short term, not in the long term, but in the short term, can really, really retard science, because scientists, they're just not very different from any of us. We all have unconscious assumptions that often we don't bring to the fore. And when we do, sometimes we're just wrong.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chet is with us in Maquonago. Chet, hi.
Hello, it's Chet. Yeah, nice to hear from you. I'm totally relating to what you're saying about the everything you eat makes you. I teach a botany class to a bunch of fifth graders, and I'll start the day saying, first I'll say I'll show my thumbnail. Say, you see this thumbnail? That's a pork chop I had about a week ago. You know, but the funnest thing I like to do, and I think this relates to what you're saying, is I'd like to start the class off also with a question. I would ask them, or tell them, I says, well, everything you eat comes from the soil. And they would often argue with me, you know, no, what if you were raised in a cannibal family, or what about fish and all this other stuff they would ask me. But the thought that everything you eat comes from the soil it seemed kind of radical too, but it always ends up there. And then always seems to end with us saying, well, who makes the soil for us, you know? And it's the trees, and that's how I get into the botany end of it. But the trees and the plants make soil for us so we can grow food, so that we can make fingernails. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Chet, thanks a lot for the call. And Dan, you spend some time on photosynthesis and the mystery of how plants convert energy from the, or it was a mystery of how plants convert energy from the sun, and that does all the things that Chet just said.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we really are creatures of plants. And it all goes back to photosynthesis. You know, when I was in school, I probably learned about photosynthesis, but I paid it no mind. Now I think it's the most amazing reaction ever in the world. It was invented by bacteria several billion years ago. Now, of course, it's in plants. And here's what it is. You take carbon dioxide from the air, you take hydrogen from water, and you take energy from the sun, and you make sugar out of it. And then from that sugar, you can make other organic compounds. So this is one of the many mind-blowing things that I learned in the book, is that 93% of your mass actually comes from photosynthesis. 83% of your mass was once just carbon dioxide floating in the air, and another 10% was hydrogen that was in the water. So, you know, we really are completely products, in a sense, of both plants and photosynthesis.
Thanks for that call, Chet. We're talking to Dan Levitt about his new book, What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Staying with the mind-blowing theme, Dan, part of that process that took a while to figure out also was how cells convert stuff to energy, and just the sheer rate of what's going on, the chemical reactions in a cell. Can you give us a sense of the scale, how quickly our cells are creating energy for us?
So there's an energy currency in our cells called ATP, and your average cell consumes and therefore has to remake 10 to 100 million of them every single second. And the way it does that is unbelievable. This was another incredible thing that I learned, which is it's done in a little chemical factory in your cell called a mitochondria. The mitochondria has little electric currents inside, made not of electrons, but of protons. Again, protons from the Big Bang. And those protons drive these nanomachines, these unbelievable nanomachines called ATP synthase. And why I call them machines is that they've got a rotor that spins at up to 300 revolutions per second. And then there's another piece that creates the ATP, and it's connected, interlinked to another piece that kicks the ATP off into the cell. It's a very beautiful, sophisticated machine, and it kind of looks almost water wheelish, like something that Leonardo da Vinci would create. And that creates all of the energy in your body. Fun thing about that is, if you were to take all the mitochondria in your body that create your energy and lay them out flat, they would cover two basketball courts. There are that many of them.
Wow.
And they create as much energy in your body as a 100-watt light bulb.
In the book, you tackle a lot of answered questions, things that we figured out. Well, we, people smarter than me, figured out over the decades. What to you are a couple of the biggest still unanswered questions about what makes us what and who we are?
Well, the origin of life is a topic, is a subject that we have a lot of very good theories about. But that one, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. How exactly did the first cell form? And then the big one that I don't tackle in my book is consciousness. You know, I do talk a lot about how the molecules in our cells, 100 trillion molecules in each of our 30 trillion cells, creates life. And we know a tremendous amount about that. But then how all the nerve cells in our brain create consciousness, that's still one of the biggest mysteries in science.
Having gone through this process and written this book, do you look at your food differently now?
Yes. There's a wonderful quote that one scientist said is, when I see people walking down the street, essentially I'm paraphrasing, I see plants rearranged.
Do you feel different as a human being, this as a holder of these 13 billion year old atoms?
You know, I do, because you know, I learned that even the simplest cell is unbelievably complex and worthy of respect. And we are made of 30 trillion cells. You know, I mentioned that each one has 100 trillion atoms. If they were each the width, the thickness of a dollar bill, and you were to stack them up, they would go up to the moon and back like almost 30 times. And so it's almost impossible for us to appreciate how truly sophisticated we are. Our cells are filled with all kinds of unbelievable sophisticated mechanisms that were built by, again, from particles that came down to Earth willy-nilly, ultimately from the Big Bang.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dan Levitt. He's a documentarian who produces films about science and history. We talked to him about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Now I'd like to take a moment to courageously offer my regrets for certain events that may have happened. Rest assured, I'm not the sort of person who would do that sort of thing, and I'm very sorry to anyone who was oversensitive or foolish enough to misinterpret my actions or intentions in a negative light. Please know that my anguish over these events outweighs the impact on anyone who was harmed by those actions and who, when you think about it, probably had it coming. In closing, I express my willingness to put it all behind us by graciously accepting your forgiveness. Okay, that wasn't an actual apology for anything in particular. It was a demonstration of some lessons from our next guests, lessons in how not to do an apology. In their blog and in their new book, they say apologies are good, they're valuable, they help rebuild social ties if we do them better than I just did. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find it difficult in your life to apologize and to phrase it the right way? What were you taught about apologizing growing up? How do you teach your kids about saying they're sorry? What's the best apology you've ever gotten? What's the worst? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel are the founders of the website Sorry Watch, which analyzes public apologies, and their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. They're both authors and writers. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And
that
Marjorie,
was a great apology.
I was going to say, Marjorie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. That was one of the worst apologies I've ever heard.
I was going to ask. I really tried. I drew real life lessons from your book. Marjorie, how does that stack up in the world of bad apologizing?
That was just gorgeously terrible. That hit just about every bad point other than I'm not perfect and I'm on a journey.
I am on a journey. It's true. Now, Susan, on a serious note, part of the point in tracking apologies and writing this book is you see a lot of benefits to good apologies. What do apologies do for us as people, as a society?
I think both as people and individuals and as a society, a good apology leaves us in better shape than we were in before. It not only heals relationships, but it leaves them stronger.
Marjorie, what led you and Susan into tracking apologies, both at SorryWatch.com and now with this new book?
We are both journalists and we love to research and we are longtime friends. And I used to live in San Francisco, where Susan still lives, and now I'm in New York, although I have lots of Wisconsin family. And when I moved, Susan had this great idea that we could collaborate on this subject that interested both of us. And so we started doing the blog in 2012. And then in 2016, I think apologies really came to people's attention and the forefront of more people's interest when we had a president who had an innovative new take on apologies and not apologizing. And then we thought we could go into some research and really explore the notion of why apologies can be really courageous, difficult, vulnerable, brave acts in a book. So we did a lot more research, and here we are.
And Susan, I wanted to ask about that. This idea sometimes that, well, I don't want to apologize because I don't want to admit wrongness. It makes me seem weak, maybe, if I apologize. Make the case for what Marjorie just said, that apologizing can be a sign of a certain strength.
Well, when you apologize, you make yourself vulnerable. You put yourself in a one-down position, something that we just instinctively avoid. But if you can push through that, actually apologize, you will look stronger. You will look more like a grown-up, more like a good person. And so ironically, if you go through and you let yourself look weak, you'll end up looking stronger.
Talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can call in with your questions, your experiences with apologizing or lack of apologies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll spend some time on bad apologies. But Marjorie, can you start us off with the basics of what the elements are in a good apology?
Yeah, we say that you can apologize really well in 6.5 easy steps. They're easy to say, but psychologically, they can be really hard to do. Number one is you use the words, I'm sorry, or I apologize. You don't talk about regret as you did in your terrible apology in that opened the segment. Number two, you name the thing that you did. You have to say it. Number three is you show that you understand why what you did was bad and hurtful. Number four is don't make excuses, which is all too easy to do. You can explain what you need to explain, but be really careful not to turn that into making excuses. Number five is say what you're doing to ensure that this won't happen again. What steps are you taking? And number six is if you can make an offer of repair of some sort, which isn't always a possible thing to do, but if you can make reparations, do that. And the 6.5, the all important half step, is listen, let the other person have their say.
Susan, how do we get ourselves in the right mindset? You know, I know when I make mistakes and offend other people or, you know, just harm people in my life, I get defensive, right? I don't want to admit that I'm a bad guy. How do I get myself from there to a position where like, well, wait, I did do something that, hurt somebody in my life. How do I get there?
Well, one thing that you can do is you can practice. You can practice on little things. Oh, I'm sorry. The salt is in the kitchen after all, and kind of get past the barrier of doing that. But one of the things that I think we're doing with the website is we give a lot of examples of bad apologies. In my research with learning, animal learning, in fact, I discovered that one of the ways that animals and people learn things is by watching others be taught. And so looking at bad examples of apologies, which we have lots of in the book, some of them pretty funny, is a really good way to learn how to do a good apology.
Marjorie, in the book, you share what the two of you view as a good apology. This is superstar Lizzo apologizing. She used the word spaz in one of her recent songs, a word used against people with disabilities often. Can you share some of that apology with us and why you found it was thought it was a successful one?
Yeah, it was interesting. Both Beyonce and Lizzo had both used this word that is a slur against people with disabilities. And I just like, Lizzo is just no nonsense. She went in, she got out, she didn't turn it all about this. I'll read it to you. This is from her Instagram. It's been brought to my attention that there is a harmful word in my new song, Girls. Let me make one thing clear. I never want to promote derogatory language. As a fat Black woman in America, I've had many hurtful words used against me. So I understand the power words can have, whether intentionally or in my case, unintentionally. I'm proud to say there's a new version of Girls with a lyric change. This is the result of me listening and taking action. As an influential artist, I'm dedicated to being part of the change I've been waiting to see in the world. XOXO, Lizzo. So, you know, it's a little bit self-aggrandizing, but you're allowed to do that when you are Lizzo. But, you know, the important thing here is she changed it before she even apologized, right? Like an apology isn't just empty words, it's taking action. And that's really the impressive thing that she did. And she wasn't defensive and she owned it.
Susan, where do people start to go wrong? Now, and let's not talk about celebrities here necessarily, but in our daily lives, what are some of the most common pitfalls when we try to apologize but don't hit some of those good notes?
Well, one of them is not even saying you're sorry, saying, I feel bad about that. And then there's a real temptation to go into how bad you feel. Oftentimes we summarize some of the bad apologies as sorry if, sorry but, sorry you. Sorry you is where you turn around and accuse the other person of being so annoying you had to do the bad thing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I went through a 12-step program, actually several of them, and you know, I was a very active participant. I went through counseling, and you know, the 12 steps make amends. Well, I tried to make sure I did that, and I you know, it wasn't near as bad of an experience I thought it was. But the flip side of that is, in recent years, I've had three people make these kind of, I call them fake apologies, you know, and your guest, you brought it up, you know, I'm sorry, but, or you this, or, and one fellow, I was sitting with my girlfriend and he came up to me to apologize. And then when he got done, he started walking away. He says, well, I don't know what I'm apologizing for, but I guess I'm sorry. And I turned to my girlfriend and said, well, he just took it all back. It would have been better if he would have said nothing. Yeah. You know?
Randy, I want to ask, in that 12-step program, this is, I think, something a lot of people have experience with. Like, when you did the step where you're making amends and making apologies, like, did you feel like, hey, I'm ticking off a box here? Or did you come in with a sense like, hey, I did this person wrong and I'm really taking a shot at making amends for it?
Oh, I felt horrible about the things, you know, but, you know, I think it's also, you need to be self-reflective and really do a really strong looking depth into, and putting yourself in the other person's shoes too. And I think that's really important. And it seems like the apologies I mentioned, they never once tried to put themselves in my shoes. And I just thought that's kind of an odd thing, you know.
I gotcha. Randy, thank you so much for sharing that. Marjorie, Randy gives us a lot to work with there. What do you think?
First of all, congrats to Randy for, you know, doing recovery and for having all of this really good insight into apologies. One of the things we point out is that not everyone is as good at the, you know, a lot of times when people begin a 12-step program, they're super excited to go out there and make amends and, you know, make a fearless moral inventory. And that often means apologizing without thinking about the really thinking about the impact of your apology on the other person. So if you're approaching someone who hasn't heard from you in 5 years and may have ended, your relationship may have ended poorly because of whatever drove you into recovery, think for a minute before you go off like a fire hose with your apologies. And it sounds like Randy really did that, that his he kept at top of mind the fact that apologies are about the other person. And then when someone says to you, I guess, that.
Thanks for sharing your experiences, Randy, on both sides of apologies. We're talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel about their new book. It's called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten that apology that just made things worse? Have you gotten an apology that changed your life maybe for the better? Do you have difficulties apologizing, even when you know maybe you should? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel. Their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies, chock full of advice on how to make a good apology and examples of how to make a bad one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about apologizing? Are you good at it, or is it hard for you to do? If so, you are not alone. Have you ever gotten a good one or a bad one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Middleton. Pat, hi.
Hi. So on the infrequent occasion when I've had to call a company over something that wasn't quite right, in my estimation, it seems like there's this probably written by lawyers or risk managers type of reaction that I get, and I wonder if others do too, which seems like it's built to deflect liability and just simply say, it doesn't matter really what the issue is. I'm sorry you feel that way. And then we never get really to the what is the issue. It's more about how they're sorry, how I feel. It really is a why bother kind of conversation, and it, maybe that's the whole point. I don't know. But I was wondering what you think about that.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, you've got a whole chapter on corporate apologies and non-apologies in the book.
Yeah, I think Pat is really onto something. I think that they are reading from scripts. I have definitely had that experience myself. I remember once dealing with an airline where the perfectly nice person on the phone was apologizing repeatedly for the confusion. And there wasn't any confusion. It was a deliberate airline policy to try and get me to pay extra for my seats. But she just had to read over and over, sorry for the confusion, sorry for the confusion. And other times they'll say, you know, we wrote about a dental practice that kept saying, we're sorry you feel this way. Well, yeah, you know, my mouth won't close properly and my other dentist says it's an outrage. So those are scripts that companies give to their employees who are forced to read them. They don't make people feel better. Like Pat, we can see right through it. And it doesn't get rid of liability.
Pat, thanks a lot.
Oh, go ahead. A poor apology is actually worse than no apology. And when people, you know, people are determined to believe that this isn't the case. But a 2006 study by the Harvard Hospital System looked at the fact that good apologies do not increase the risk of, say, malpractice suits. And there is so much evidence that bad apologies actually cause them. And some malpractice lawyers think that 2/3 of malpractice suits are actually because of the failure to take responsibility and apologize and communicate openly, and people get vindictive.
Thanks a lot for that call, Pat. Liz joins us now in Sister Bay. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a situation when my mother-in-law did something not only to hurt myself, but my place of business. And she admitted she had done it. And then, you know, I expected an apology. And the apology was what you were just speaking about with the other guest. And she said, I am sorry you feel that way. But she did not say that she was sorry for what she had done or admit that it was wrong. And this was back in like 2021. And I'm just wondering, I still have problems like trying to let it go, and I'm just wondering how to move on.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Marjorie, first of all, in many situations, maybe where we should give an apology, you talk about this in the book. We don't see ourselves as the bad guy. We come up with reasons why we weren't wrong in the first place.
Right. Like, I'm sure your mother-in-law has decided that there were really good reasons that she did what she did. And again, as I just said, with, you know, on a corporate level, a bad apology is in so many ways worse and more hurtful than no apology. And I'm really sorry that that's what you got. I wonder, I don't know what the caller's relationship with her mother-in-law is like. I don't know if you have the kind of relationship where you can sit down and say, look, I'm still really hurting over what happened. And I would like to talk to you more about it. And I would like you to address. And then you say the X, Y, and Z, and, you know, you might want to do it in a letter because people often have a little more time to process and are a little less defensive when they have a little bit of distance rather than being cornered. But I don't think the caller should feel bad about feeling bad because that's what a bad apology does.
Thanks for that call, Liz. We are talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. Back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Mequon. Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a dear, dear friend who was a friend for probably 30 years who got mad at me for I don't know why. She never would tell me. She stopped completely talking to me. I've tried calling. I've sent her letters. We 4 years ago, we moved out of the town that we lived in. Now, this week, her husband died, and I would really like to send her a sympathy card. I don't know if I should apologize again in that sympathy card. I don't even know if she'll read the sympathy card. I feel bad. I don't know what I did. How do you apologize for something you don't know what you did?
Beth, thanks for the call. Susan, any thoughts for Beth?
Beth, I really feel for you. That is so hard. I will say that I think it's appropriate to send her a sympathy card. And in the sympathy card, don't bring up the apology or the mystery about what the apology is supposed to be for. That would be a separate conversation, which you may or may not be able to have. So I would send a sympathy card, you know, with, you know, maybe some memories of her late husband. And then if you can still try in a separate conversation to say, you know, I really feel bad that we're estranged and I feel like I did something, but I don't know what it is. Can you help me figure it out?
Beth, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. Alicia joins us now in Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Alicia?
I just wanted to say that I'm in retail pharmacy, and a lot of times people come to the pharmacy after maybe getting a not-so-good diagnosis, pretty bad news, and maybe feeling sad and sometimes angry, and they blow up because one prescription may be there and not another that the doctor said that they would send, or maybe there's something wrong with the prescription, so I have the prescription itself, but there's a problem with it. And so people get very angry, and I have had people call after they leave the pharmacy, call back and apologize. So I just wanted to say that those apologies do mean the world.
Alicia, thanks a lot for the call. And Marjorie, that takes us to a good point to end on. Leave us with some hope for what we can do with a good apology.
A good apology can mend fences. It can strengthen relationships. We have a post on our website about kintsugi, the Japanese art of fixing cracks with glue and gold. And a thing becomes stronger. The cracks don't disappear, but the thing is stronger and more beautiful after a fracture.
Marjorie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Susan, thanks for being with us.
You bet. That was great.
Been talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel, founders of the website Sorry Watch. They joined us to talk about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.